Thank you. Well, I'm in a sort of, because of my own ambiguity, I'm in a sort of in a very strange position, because I was trained, let me start by saying that I was trained as a physicist, well, an engineer first and then a physicist, and worked on the theory of phase transitions. And about 15 years ago, I decided I want to do something else. And I've been now for about 10 years at the Pasteur Institute, where I am one of the two theorists in residence for a staff of about 3,000 people. So this gives you an idea of the social status of theory in biology. And so it is not without a personal effort that I've reached the situation where I can talk about the computability of biology. I think that, you know, when I started out in biology, many physicists were going to neural networks, which was a sort of it seemed like the thing to do, a place where you could apply such things as spin glass theory, replicatrix, and so on and so forth, to a problem of true human interest. And I went to a conference where I saw a talk by Bernard Widrow, who was one of the pioneers in this field, an electronic engineer, I believe. And he started out, I mean, he gave this lecture where he gave this history of neural networks as he saw them. So he said he started out basically with the with a one neuron model. And that one neuron model was supposed to answer the following question: is it going to rain tomorrow in San Francisco? And the neuron was fed with 100 pieces of data. Each of them saying, over the past 100 days, had it rained or not in San Francisco? So there was yes, no, yes, yes, and so on. These became, of course, very quickly 0 and 1 binary variables. And then there was one output, which was the answer to the question, will it rain tomorrow? And the way the network was trained was by taking the data for the past 10 years or so, feeding them into the machine one after the other, and getting to adjust the weights with which these zeros and ones were fed into the system, and the threshold with which, you know, they were then summed, of course, these W, I, over the, let's call these SI so that you won't feel too bad. And this sum had to be above some sort of a threshold before you could say yes or no. And basically, by adjusting the weights by a procedure known as the perceptron algorithm, they had arrived at a system that could basically answer correctly to all to the data set. In other words, the data that had been fed in it was correctly taken into account and gave the correct answer for the next day. And then, they went on to apply this to actual weather prediction. And they got to about 70% success rate. This was in 1950. They called the Weather Bureau and they said, look, we have this thing here. It's a one neuron business. And you have about 70% success rate. So someone on the other end of the line said, this is Widrow speaking, what do you mean? We have a 70% success rate. So Widrow said, well, maybe you could fund us a little bit. You know, we're onto a good thing here. But he said they never heard about them again. The Weather Bureau remained silent. Well, there are some simple way. There are some simple algorithms. Well, another good algorithm is to say the opposite of what the Weather Bureau is saying. That is not too bad either, sometimes. So here you have a simple theoretical biological system. It's quite computable, I would say. And it's pitted against the Navier-Stokes equations, which the guys at the Weather Bureau were really trying hard to compute. And so I would like to sort of put the question on its head. And maybe one of the questions would be, one of the good questions would be, is hydrodynamics computable? Because that sort of biology is quite computable. I have no problem with that. So is biology computable from first principles? It's certainly one of the first, is physics computable? Is one of the things you want to really ask yourself. And I'm not going to answer that question. But I just want to point out that the interest of the question is probably not as, it's not such a pressing question as one would think, because in order to compute a weather prediction, it doesn't really help to go back to quarks. You don't really expect that going back to quarks or strings, where I left physics some time ago. You know, it's not clear that that going to string theory in order to compute the weather will do you really much good. And it's not even clear that it would be interesting to go back to string theory to do that. And in biology, in many ways, the answer is, as I will try and explain, the same, basically. Now, if you want to compute biology, you know, to make quantitative predictions, in other words, about biology, you are faced immediately with a major problem. And it's an insuperable problem, really. And it's the following. It is summarized rather well by the sentence my teacher of mechanics at the university used to give us once in a while. He would say, in mechanics, if there are three bodies, there is one too much. And physics is exactly like that. It is the art of cutting off all what you think is some sort of irrelevant context to bring the problem down to its simplest form of expression. This is the highest, the most revered form of physics, is as the system goes ever to more its more simplest forms of expression. And once you've cut it down to almost nothing, like two particles, that is elegant physics that you can then work on. And I remember reading a book on statistical mechanics by Richard Mattock, where he said that, well, two bodies might be too much in classical mechanics. In quantum electrodynamics, no body at all is already too much, because the vacuum already poses some interesting problems. Now, in biology, you can cut up an organism into various pieces. However, if you go down below the cell, you are not doing biology anymore. The cell is the smallest autonomous living thing there is on Earth. And if you cut a cell in two, you are doing biochemistry. If you are... That's already biochemistry. It's finished. I mean, you've really cut the system too far. You've gone too far. So then the question is, what do you do when the simplest unit that you can deal with is a cell? And a cell is an incredibly complicated thing. You can spend your life looking at just one type of cell. And then you want to put these cells together in an organism. And you want to put organisms together in a population. and in an ecosystem where cells are not to be cut in biology, they're not to be cut not in DNA and proteins and not in genes or gene networks even. They are not to be cut at all. I mean, the gene networks don't make any sense unless they are in the context of the cell. So then, what do you do? What do you do? The problem is even worse than what you may think from what I've just told you. It's even worse because no two cells are the same. You see, you take, whenever you think that, you know, people tell you an experiment has been done on a particular cell type. For example, experiments used to be done on fibroblasts. That's a very standard sort of cell they can put in culture and look at. Well, it turns out that fibroblasts from here and from there are not the same. And two fibroblasts, no matter how close you take them out of, will not be the same. Even the same cell, after you've waited a bit, is not the same it used to be. So I would say not only is biology not really computable, it's not even experimentable. Because the key to science is reproducibility, right? So if you never do the same experiment twice, how can you claim that you are doing science at all? Well, as you probably know, biologists have worked their way around that problem. And the way they do work around this problem is by talking about what is called preparations. Model systems, preparations. What is a model system? A model system is just one organism, and it's not really one organism. It's a lineage of an organism that lives in a laboratory. I mean, the members of the lineage have not left the laboratory in a very long time. And so the animals, or the members of this model system, this could be Drosophila or Cynorhabditis elegans, they are totally standardized sort of animals. And on these animals, you define standardized procedures to prepare them in such a way that you may hope that whatever results you're going to get from a particular experimental procedure are going to be the same, I was going to say over and over again, but that is not quite the case. A typical experiment in the lab where I live, I would say that if the experiment works 3 times in 5, you can publish, basically. So biology is experimentable, but
what happens in the other two cases?
Well, you find a good reason why it shouldn't have worked in that particular case. And, you know, and the fact is, it sounds outrageous, but
what
the fact.
Does work mean? Agree with your preconceptions?
No. Work means that you get the same thing a certain number of times. You know, and of course, it may have to do with your preconceptions, because if you are a postdoc and the lab boss thinks that this is not a possible result, well, and he has good reasons for that. You know, it's not a matter of, not necessarily a question of tyranny. Although there is such an aspect. Now, one could talk about the differing sociology of biology and physics. It's not the subject of the talk, but. You know, you do the experiment you convince yourself within reasonable doubt that a particular result obtains, and then you know that you can publish it. Of course, if the result is really very strange, then you really have to get better statistics. I mean, but on the whole, you are satisfied with relatively little statistics, especially in molecular biology. And it's always very strange, you know, to read these proceedings coming from Cold Spring Harbor they're called Cold Spring Harbor Proceedings in Quantitative Biology, where most of the time, except for a few statistics, you don't see one number. So people have worked their way around the problem of experimentability in biology. You cannot cut the system into an infinite number of, at infinitum. Well, then you prepare it in some way that you hope. First of all, by choosing a model organism, you decide to look at a certain phenomenon in that organism, and in that organism only. And you hope that this may carry over to life in general, but it doesn't have to. Because, of course, as a physicist or as a theorist, the only reason to talk about the model is to say, well, look, the rest of the world is like that too. Not so in biology. In biology, we had Eric Vishaus give us a wonderful talk about the genetics of the fly. He was one of the precursors of the developmental genetic of the fly. Now, when Eric Vishaus and Janni Nussbaum-Volhatz set out to do the complete screening for the genetics, the developmental genetics of Drosophila, no one, I think, had any idea that what they would find would not be good just for Drosophila. Nevertheless, it was a pluri-annual project. You know, it took several years to get these screenings complete. Nevertheless, they felt it was worth doing, because, and in a sense, they were right, because even if Drosophila is a totally special type of beast that doesn't develop by using genes homologous to anything, still, it's Drosophila. It's a living creature, and interesting all by itself. And this is a motivation for the biologist, which is at least as strong as that of trying to find something that would be generalizable to the rest of the universe. So, when I started doing theoretical biology, basically, my approach was, and it has remained so, and it has sort of worked rather nicely for me, and so I just give you the recipe for making biology computable in some sense, has been to make preparations or model systems, but making them on the computer. And by making a preparation on the computer, what I mean is this. You cannot, I mean, computers are really stupid beasts, as you know. You have to tell them everything. The answer to all kinetic constants must be there, you know, to the 16th decimal place in a computer. Of course, most of the decimal place are zero, but never mind. I mean, you have to give all these numbers to full precision or double precision. You cannot hope to do that, especially if you are intent on staying with a complete cell, of course. You cannot hope to do that. What do you do then? Well, what a biologist does is, of course, he prepares a particular system that has the sort of behavior he's interested in at a given moment and on which he's going to be able to operate. And in a way, my approach was to do the same. See, let me build a computer preparation, a system, usually a system of equations, that shows some behavior which can be interpreted in terms of biology. And then, on that system, behaving as I would like it to behave, that is in accordance with a certain number of experiments, do the same sort of manipulations that biologists do. you see? And these are not complicated manipulations, really. They're a bit complicated to put on the computer, but they're not really that complicated. In developmental biology, which is what I work mostly on these days, the sort of experiment you want to do is to say you take a tissue, and this tissue has a number of properties. Say I take at random a French flag sort of tissue with cells that are red, blue, and green. And, you know, one sort of game that you will want to play is to say, well, let me take some cells from this place and put them here, do this graft, and see what happens to these cells. So that's an experiment that you can do on a computer also, once you have a system that has, you know, these three categories of cells. And the question is, of course, once you've done this experiment on the computer, can you do the same experiment in real life? And of course, it can be done sometimes. And then the question is, well, is the outcome on the computer and the outcome in real life the same? And if it is, well, it's satisfying in some sense, but of course it means that you're out of a job for a while. You have to wait for another prediction, another experiment until the thing fails somehow, and then you know that your preparation is just not adequate for the sort of phenomenon you want to study. So in this sense, now I give you, about halfway in the talk, I give you the answer to the question, I mean, my own personal answer to the question, which is, I am not going to try ever to be exhaustive about the description of the system, because already in the computer description there is a lot more than what I can possibly know about the system. I will have to make all sorts of guesses, and in when you write a paper you say educated guesses, but in real life it's very often uneducated guesses, because there is no education whatsoever that could help you in a particular answer a particular question. And once you have, you're satisfied that your system does, you know, what the experimental setup is doing, you can start playing with it exactly like an experimenter would play with it. And as long as you don't have to change too many things to the description, you say you're satisfied and you have a computational description of the experimental setup that you are interested in. There are, of course, you know, in the description you adopt, it is unbelievably simplified compared to the actual system. Typically, people study together the interactions of, let us say, 5 or 6 components, molecules, genes, and so on and so forth. They simply have not, and I think no one has, the intellectual apparatus to deal with more variables at any given moment. Of course, statistical physics deals with an infinite number of parameters and variables. But there is a cheat, because all these parameters, you know, are divided into a few categories. These are all spin 1/2 particles, for example, interacting particles of, you know, very few types. Now here, you are dealing with objects which each have their own special identity. Each of these molecules is the special result of an evolutionary process. It has been optimized, suboptimized to do a variety of things. It usually is used in a variety of contexts. You get the information that you put in your model from these various contexts, you know, because you are desperate to find any sort of information, really. So that basically, if you wish, is my answer to the problem, my own personal answer to the problem. Now, biologists, of course, don't really ask themselves the question whether biology is computable or not. I mean, the only biologist I know who asked himself this question was Lewis Wolpert, who once wrote a short piece in Current Biology called "Is the Embryo Computable?"
I still don't know. What was your answer? No, I didn't know that. I had a series of articles about what you would ask the good fairy, you would answer any question you liked. But the fairy would only give a yes, no, or a number. The right question was, what was it? I don't know what people
What is the question? Now, when you talk with biologists about these questions of computability, I have to say very frankly that they are quite muddled about this. But I must say that the physicists too are rather muddled about it, because they don't really realize what it is to deal with the living world. So you come across, very often, you come across arguments that seem conclusive to the theorist or even to the biologist who doesn't really understand, and which are simply preposterous. And I would like to spend the next few minutes really telling you about one of these arguments, which is really, it's been floating around forever and ever, and spreads a lot of confusion on all sides. And it is the question of whether the genes, because modern biology is mostly about genes, whether genes have the power to construct the human brain. Now, there have been many answers to this question. And basically, an argument you find fairly often is something like the following. Look, they say, you have 10 to the 11 cells in our brain, or thereabouts. Now, each of these 10 to 11 cells makes maybe 10 to the fourth connections with other nerve cells. Now, take one neuron, just consider for a moment just one neuron, one connection coming from one neuron. That connection can land on 10 to the 11 cells. That's 10 to the 11 possibilities. Each of the connections coming from that neuron, that's 10 to the fourth, has the same number, essentially, of possibilities. So, and you have to do this for all the neurons in the system, and that's so that's the number of possibilities you have to wire a brain, just about. I call it the neuro-astrological formula. It is an important formula, I think, because it demonstrates rigorously to many biologists that the brain cannot be constructed by the genes or by anything else, for that matter. Now, there is a basic flaw I can give an anthropomorphic argument here. The simple fact that we are here sitting and talking about these things proves that there must be a flaw in the argument. And the flaw is, you see, mathematicians, first of all, do give this sort of argument. You have to realize. And some biologists buy these arguments. And for example, you may have heard of neural Darwinism. Neural Darwinism, I mean, I've never heard the author of neural Darwinism say clearly that this is what he meant. Yes. However, neural Darwinism is an answer to this problem, to this perceived riddle. The idea that you need some sort of a selection process inside there to boil it down to something that, you know, is manageable by the sources of information we know we have in ourselves. I mean, neural Darwinism has many problems of its own. In particular, it takes out of Darwinism only the selective aspect of it and not the reproductive aspect. I don't know that synapses are reproducing themselves to be selected. So it's, you know, there's some problems there too, but you could actually argue, if you think about it, you could actually argue that there isn't enough information in the genome to code for the position of each atom in a fly.
Each atom.
That's an enormous amount of information. And of course, the genes don't have to code for that much information. Why? Because genes use the laws of chemistry and physics, you know, to assemble atoms in certain ways, in certain highly restricted ways, so that they just have to twiddle the biochemical mechanisms to make an organism. They don't have to code for the position of each atom. And in many ways, the same is true about the brain, you see. This describes a brain that would be built by a sort of demon that could connect every neuron to another neuron. That demon really faces this task. Okay? However, the genes don't do exactly that. They don't do that. The genes, well, what could they do? They could do many things. And now you tell the biologist, listen, of course this is true, but you know that not every nerve cell is connected to every nerve cell. What could you do? What would you imagine would be enough information so that the brain could be built by the standard cell developmental mechanisms that we know are at work in each and every cell? The answer to that, I think, from a reasonable biologist would be, listen, if you tell me that each cell in the brain has its own identity, it knows who she is. She knows who she is, okay? Let me be politically correct. Then there is no problem. Each cell knows who she is. She can read the state of its neighbors and decides whether it wants to connect or not to connect, and so on and so forth. And now, as a theorist, you can astound the biologist by telling him, well, how many genes do you think that would require? Labeling each cell in a unique way. And the answer is, well, with 37 genes you can do it. Okay? You need even less than that, actually. Why 37? I just betrayed the answer. Because, of course, if you take genes to be on or off, if you have 37 such genes, the number of states they can describe is 2 to the 37, and that turns out to be more or less the number of neurons in our brain.
37.
Just cadherins, there are 150 in the human genome. Actually, with 50 such genes, you can label each synapse in a unique way. Now, you might say, well, all that is nice and fine, but the system has to regulate the way these genes are expressed in an intelligent way. Well, we have heard many talks during this BioNet school on regulatory regions of the genome. Regulatory regions have a combinatorial structure, basically. These are regions on the DNA. You have genes, and in front of them you have regulatory regions, which basically decide whether a particular gene downstream from them, usually downstream, whether this gene will be active or not, will be actively transcribed and made translated into protein. And of course, many of the proteins that are controlled in this way by what are called transcription factors are themselves transcription factors. So you have a very nice dynamical system. And not only are these elements controlled, expressed not only may these elements be expressed in a combinatorial fashion, but we know for sure that they are controlled in combinatorial fashion. And it's a game that you can play to imagine when you have about, say, 120 binding sites for various transcription factors in a particular gene promoter, which decide whether this gene is going to be expressed or not. with 120 variables, how many Boolean functions can you make to control in a unique way these 37 labeled genes? I think you have more than plenty power to do that. Okay? So the idea that the genetic system, and you can read many famous books where, you know, the genetic system is not powerful enough to code for the brain. Well, the genetic system can code for the brain. It can very easily code for the brain. And then the question becomes, I think, the question becomes, why is it then that it's not like that? Why is it that we need learning if the genes can do it? And it's a very strange thing, really. And a question to be asked, when you see learning, you really have to ask yourself, why is there learning there? Why do we rely on learning, which is a fault-prone procedure, when the genes could do it in a mechanical fashion? I give you an example of a very strange one that strikes me very much, and I have no explanation for it, I tell you immediately. A bird hatches, is able to recognize immediately features in the profile of its predator. They hatchlings, they've just come out of the egg, they have had no visual experience whatsoever. Mm-hmm. An eagle passes over, they go. Obviously, something the genes must have, in one way or another, encoded in there. Now, the same bird must learn to sing. Now, I ask you, the bird song is, of course, I mean, the people who are specialists of bird song realize this is, you know, they know this is an exquisitely fine process. Nevertheless, it's not that complicated that it might not be encoded in the genetic system. Yet, birds have to listen to their congeners, and they have to listen to themselves as well. If you cut the feedback and they don't listen to themselves singing, they won't learn to sing properly. And I have no answer to this riddle, really, and I don't know anyone who has one answer. Otherwise, I would, of course, tell you. So basically, biologists have been led to believe sometimes that the computability problem in their discipline is a lot worse than it actually is. Obviously, lots of things can be done in a fairly reasonable mathematical way. No, there is a combinatorial explosion, but it's quite under control as far as we can tell. So these are just a few, you know, these were just a few remarks about what it means to compute or to understand biology, whether it's understandable or not, and trying to clear up a few of the misunderstandings about this. There's one last little thing I would like to discuss, which is the question of universality. Physicists have been, well, whether it's training or taste, I don't know, but they value universality. The broader the range of applicability of a result in physics, the more satisfied you are with it. In biology, as I tried to say about the Drosophila development, the notion of wide applicability may be a byproduct of your work sometimes, but it's not absolutely necessary for gratification or for professional advancement, for that matter. So, well, is there some sort of universality in biology that we would, you know, that we can then sort of rely on to feel better as physicists trying to look into these problems? Well, the only universality, but it is a very powerful one, I think, comes from ancestry. Although all these beasts are remarkably complicated, well, nevertheless, they all share the same ancestry. And their selection comes into play to tell you that if something works, you're not going to try and invent something else. So that many of the objects you are dealing with in biological systems are actually present in one way or another. The correct technical word is homology. They are present, homology and also paralogy. They are present, these objects or their copies are present in just about anything that is alive today. And not only that, but they sometimes, quite unbelievably so, perform the same functions in very remote types of beasts. So when you, the very fact that you can define a model system basically relies on this notion that there is common ancestry, and therefore you cannot expect, in spite of the fact that it's always an a posteriori result of research, that there is something in common between model systems and life in general, or that your preparation is a good representation of some cellular process, in spite of the fact that it's a posteriori and not a priori like it is in physics, nevertheless, quite a few things, and very amusing and funny things, can be done in computing biology. Thank you.
So 27 genes. So in order to specify uniquely 10 to 11 patterns, you need to simultaneously read all the 27 genes.
Yes.
That would be a little bit.
Well, you know, reading them, for example, on the surface of a cell. I don't know how many molecules there are on the surface of a cell. There are many, many molecules.
You're saying there is 37 receptors. And
yes, for example, yes. That's one way.
But to lay down the pattern requires a lot more.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to do it reliably is a totally different thing. Now, here you have, with 37, you have no room for mistakes or environmental disturbances. Of course, if you want to do it reliably, then you have to start adding to it. But the rest is extra.
What is the relation of that model, to the real system? What is the sort of relation? What's the transformation from the real system to this system?
Okay, in the case of my own work, the transformation is rather simple. It's a visual one, in the sense that you have images that that are basically, they look like a video game on a computer screen. You might describe them at some level, though it wouldn't really make you very it wouldn't make things very explicit, at some sort of cellular automaton that tells you that certain objects are present at a particular space, at time in a point in space and time. And this could be, for example, a cell nucleus and a cell cytoplasm and a cell membrane, and there may be molecules sitting at that point, and genes active in the nucleus, and proteins appearing, and other cells being nearby reading the concentrations of some of the molecules that would end up on the membrane of the neighboring cell, and so on and so forth. And these things would basically display states of activity that would be the result of some dynamical system evolving under these various interactions. And most importantly, you would have these cells basically read the state of their neighbors and move in various directions, because when you talk about gene networks, you tend to forget that that is only part of the game. Basically, we have a shape. We are formed by various processes, very complicated and very difficult to visualize processes of folding of surfaces in three dimensions called gastrulation and neurulation. These are very complicated processes even to visualize. It's not always easy, and some biologists just are very happy to remain in two dimensions, actually. And these processes of motion are really what shape us in many ways.
All that, you'll try to put all that in the computer?
All that is in the computer, yes. It is not an exhaustive description, as I said, but it is a description where you put most of the elements that the experimentalists believe are important in this process. And as to the interactions about these elements, about which the biologists know usually rather little, you have to make these famous educated or uneducated guesses, basically.
Going back to a simple model, Sidney Brenner's C. elegans, where there's 1,400 neurons, and the lineage of all the neurons is null. So
Cinerabditis elegans. This is the last year's Nobel Prize in physics. It's an animal where. Yes.
So there are 1,400 neurons and they're all in the wiring diagram.
Well, 1,400 cells, 300 neurons.
The lineage is known. They're known exactly how they're related to cells the cells
at the very beginning.
But you also know how each cell is marked.
Right, so the question is, what do we know about this combinatorial coding of this? So according to you, right, we can happily label them
we could,
10 genes or so?
It's just a matter, that is the usual problem with the theorist, is to convince the experimentalist that he can actually go and search for these molecules. It's not clear it would be very interesting at this stage. You know, the sort of things you learn from C. elegans, I would say, is not so much that there is lineage, because logically, as we saw, it's a definite possibility, a very definite way of that cells are descended from the egg. But the really interesting thing, is very paradoxical, is that out of these 1,400 or so cells, 300 die in the process during development.
But again, in a learning independent fashion. So that's the case where presumably
it's all hardwired.
There is some learning behavior that's known in the one, but presumably there is very little. So
is there?
That's the case in which is biased towards this genetic determinant.
Right. I don't know whether if anyone has tried to teach anything to C. elegans. I'm not sure. But it's true that very simple animals can learn remarkably effectively a certain number of things.
Now remember, they learn aversive odors. Right? So if you couple some odor with shock, an electric or heat shock, that's something bad.
Yeah, I know. I know that in the case of the snail, which is a bit more complicated, it has 10,000 neurons. The snail, okay. The snail, you give it a carrot, a poisoned carrot, and it will avoid, that's a one-shot learning, it will avoid carrot for the rest of his life.
But the interesting thing is not what can be learned. The real thing is what it can be programmed with that this should make.
Yeah, so obviously the link between odor and feeling bad a few hours later has been built in a very strong fashion in the snail, at any rate. And in C. elegans, I don't know the details, but I seem to remember indeed that they are sensitive to a certain number of things.
Well, you know, as you know very well, each of the 10 to the 11 neurons, they don't have to know, I mean, in your calculation, they have to know, be instructed precisely how it connects. Of course, you know, even in human brain, famous example is this guy that this huge nail put through his brain, and he lost everything. And he didn't change anything except his personality. He started using obscenities, but otherwise he could use it perfectly well. You know, so, and we know people have strokes and so on. So clearly the number is much, much less than your. So how do you explain the stability of this kind of?
Well, there are very, you know, in terms of dynamical systems, you know, in abstract terms, you can understand that, you know, even in this simple perceptron, you can change the weights a little bit. You can rely on 99 days instead of 100, and you will get to something. There's quite a bit of that.
But it's remarkable, though, right? In the brain, you can remove, say, 30%,
yeah.
40%.
So there are neural network models for this. Jeff Hinton, then in Toronto. made such very beautiful models where he could actually section neural network tissue very much the same way that strokes damage.
But they're exactly the opposite of hardwired. Those are random networks, which
are trained. Yes, and some of them, yes. It's
but
not always.
Yeah, you're hardwired. Well, you can do that to your computer, right? Clearly.
No, you cannot do that to your. Well, sometimes I try, but.
Actually, you can't do it to much of
That's right.
But you may call it wired, but then you can change the nature of the synapses with experience. And that's what it tells us.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it's hardwired tells you nothing about how that is.
No, but in fact, if you think about it, you know, the dichotomy between hardwired and plastic is somewhat difficult to establish because plasticity itself relies on cellular memory. In other words, it relies on genes that are inside the cell and make it special and remember certain things. Memory, I mean, you see, 37 is actually a large number, I would say, because cells have various ways of remembering various things done with even less genes than that. You see, a nerve cell has these long processes. Now, the dendrites, you have basically an output, which is the axon, and then you have a tree, which is the dendrite, where basically input, well, that at least is a classical image, okay? Now, a neuron starts off pushing out, growing a dendrite. That's due, or correlated at any rate, with the activity of one gene called Hamlet. Now, that one gene is active for about one day in the development of the mouse. The neurons make these dendrites, and these dendrites go by themselves. Hamlet disappears from the game. It's used to do something completely different later on, you see? And that is not at all taken into this sort of reuse is not taken into account in this formula. That's why I say that 37 is an upper limit, is an upper bound on what you actually need. So the dendrite itself is composed of many molecules, and there is a genetic system that maintains the dendrite, that directs towards the dendrite what is needed to have a dendrite and to have postsynaptic endings on it and you know, and things like that. So there is a whole system to maintain the memory in a given cell of the activity of one single gene at some previous time.
With memory, you see, your limb is hardwired, but in the axolotl, if you cut the limb, every cell in the axolotl limb has its own identity along the end. And that's probably true of yours too.
What do you mean, own identity? Can you say that more precisely?
It's not established, but certainly the evidence from regeneration of limbs is that every level along the limb has a molecular identity. And Jeremy Brock's just published a paper in which a molecule is graded precisely from one end.
Meaning that the cells in the limb can know exactly where they are with respect to their neighbors.
But they might know so by reading some gradient.
Sure.
No, but the gradient has to be there. And it's not easy to see how diffuse in the sort of mess you have in.
And they remember. Because if you graph them, then they remember where they came.
There are these experiments where you cut a frog's eye and the optic nerve reconnects with
like 10 billion. Well, we've got Lemke coming up on the 5th of March. He's going to talk precisely on that.
But I remember the theories of that were to deal with this governmental problem with simple gradients.
That's right. So a gradient is actually a way of dealing. I mean, Sperry saw this notion of a gradient as an answer to this perceived problem of the how do you express and regulate in a coordinate fashion so many molecules. It was 10 million is the correct number, I think. So his idea was, well, I can make a gradient. Now, and there's a very simple rule to make sure that the wiring then comes out correct. You just assume that there is a ligand uniformly distributed for this receptor on the incoming cells, and you assume that the cells stop searching as soon as they have a given level of signaling in them, and that this establishes a wonderfully ordered connection, set of connections.
From the soul. So this is no longer believed to be the case.
No, no, no. There is experimental proof of this.
Give a talk here on the 5th of March.
There are several gradients.
Demonstrate that there are two gradients, one in the retina and one in the temptum, and how they interact.
But you see, the real problem, I think, is not so much the gradient, but how do you make the gradient? That's.
But it still is a simpler and much more efficient technique than labeling every.
Yes, indeed. But my prediction from this sort of considerations is that behind the continuous code of a gradient, it's not easy to see how a cell maintains.
Right. To determine where it gets to.
Well, I wish we knew. I mean, a lot of cells disappear and die all the time, right? So each cell has a name, but if they die, then the new cells that are grown, they also have the name and they have the same label.
But not many of your cells die.
No, like on the skin, I thought every 60 days.
Yes. But there are the cells underneath.
You see, from a dynamical systems point of view, from a physicist point of view, really, it's not easy to see how you adjust things in a cell to maintain a precise level of expression that is just a little bit above its neighbor on one direction and just a bit below its neighbor on the next in the other direction. Okay? On the other hand, I can rather easily imagine that there is a combinatorial code underlying this which directs the expression into a continuous gradient and stable gradient. There was a question.
Isn't it fairly evident that learning is adapted to be able to respond to changes in the environment? Like your example with the person with the poison carrot. If you grant that, perhaps it's not a bad idea to practice on something like birdsong that is to practice learning. We advocate that in education all the time.
Yes. No, listen, I have not. I want to dispel the impression that I've said that the whole of the brain is wired in this particular way. I'm just saying that obviously, evolution has found it fit to leave. It's not that it could not be done. No. That is my point of principle. It could be done, but it isn't done. That's fairly obvious. And then if it isn't done, you have to ask, one good question to ask is always, why was it left that way?
Because you couldn't recognize, you cannot have inbuilt the face of your mother.
Right. That is right. So in the case of birds, one theory is that they recognize each other, their neighbors, they haven't attacked each other for some while, and they recognize intruders because these intruders come from further away and they sing in a slightly different way, and so they get more aggressive. That's one theory about it.
So this is a question of all human society. If we can rerun the tape of history again, will we see ambiguous in
it? If we rerun...
How rerun?
My analogy would be very different.
Yeah. To what extent would it be very different?
There is Simon Berlin. A book by Simon... Well, you can read it.
Simon Conway Morris, basically, is a... Well, the most extreme views have been held on this problem, okay? First of all, I think it goes, the gamut ranges from Gould, who said that it was basically, most of it was a result of accident. And therefore, if you reran the movie, it would be very different. And all the way to Simon Conway Morris, who by looking at paleontological evidence, seems to think that there is somehow there was some sort of inevitability in it. It's not easy to disentangle for this result of Conway Morris from his religious convictions, for example. Absolutely, absolutely, it's the same way. No, it's absolutely the same.
Well, what is the paleontological evidence that
that points to inevitability? You mean separated development?
Well, certainly convergent evolution is one is quite strong, meaning that, you know, populations left in very different environments have evolved the same sort of. But you have to be careful because not all examples of convergent evolution are actually well documented. And for example, the case of the eye has undergone a major revision recently. People used to think that there were tens of ways of making an eye, and today it's becoming clear that most probably there is only one way with variations, and all driven by the same basic gene of, you know, which is the gene for photoreceptor expression. So
what do the biologists in this room believe between good and worse?
I'm more with Morris.
You agree with Morris?
No, I wouldn't like to say I agree, but I'm more.
More with Morris. This
is a question of punctuated evolution or...
it's like I work on the evolution of development, and it suits me to go along more with Morris. Well, it's complicated. It's about early development and what the alternative possibilities are. The real point about it is that I think, given the real complexity, could you have had a different sort of cell? And I don't think any. And no one has a clue about the origin of life in three blocks. You know, there are stories, but really, I mean, I think I was just with Leslie Orgel down at the Salk, and the origin of life simply remains. And my argument has always been, once you've got the cell, it's downhill, it's trivial after that.
What you mean by that is that, you know, the basic history of development of higher organisms would have been similar?
I think they would have been striking similar.
Well, you need an axis, you need a second axis, you know.
There's only one Cambrian explosion, which is 2 billion years after.
Well, maybe it depends on how long you prepare to wait.
Well, you see, I think it went very slowly from the cell on, because the cell was a piece of machinery designed to divide and reproduce. Now, in a multicellular organism, there's a major revolution, which is that many cells just forego this possibility in favor of a few. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, I think they had to be coerced very severely in order to respond to it. Obviously, from the point of view of propagation, it would be, I mean, you take something like Volvox. Volvox is an alga, it's about 1,000 cells. When comes the time of reproduction, only 16 of these cells actually go and give, progeny. Now, you take each cell of Volvox, it looks remarkably like Chlamydomonas, which is a one-cell alga. And you have colonies of Chlamydomonas. What does that mean? These Chlamydomonas come together, they make 1,000 cell colonies with pretty much the same structure as Volvox. But when the time comes to reproduce, they each go their own way. So that's 1,000 versus 16. It's a big factor.
Who decides on the 16?
Not me.
Well, physics is, of course, the science that deals with the universal laws that apply to every single physical system.
So do you think one universal law in biology, of course, and that's the theory of evolution?
Well, but you have, but part of it, I was thinking, you know, there's another role for theorizing other than making quantitative pictures like this. And your example, neural networks, is a good example, because those attempted to do that with some failures. Successes. They also gave, I mean, one thing that theorizing does, or models only does, is create a conceptual thing. Mm-hmm. The thing I found originally most fascinating about neural networks was a trivial, probably wrong, but an example of associative memory, of having memory that was not localizing. You could destroy half the brain, you'd still have a pretty good memory, and you could see it. You could write it down and understand it analytically, this possibility of storing things not in the way most of us, when you think about how you store papers and all that, so part of it, and you didn't talk much about that aspect of theory, which of course is one of the things that drives a lot of physicists into physics, and I imagine theorists into biology as well. I mean, if you want the bigger question, or the more conceptual question, like, for example, the brain, what is consciousness? And how do you capture that phenomena, which you don't, the fact that you can't capture it, and describe it, it is partly because you don't have the theoretical apparatus yet, or a model of what it would mean to differentiate between a network or a being entity that is or is not conscious. It's a great role of theory. You didn't talk about that at all. In the case of a cell, you might ask the question, which I was still asking him, but these questions are still there, and they show the poverty, if you want, of the theory. Not so much the stuff, but the theory, which is, what is life? What is the definition of a living being?
On that one, I can say something. You see, if we had had to wait for string theory in order to do hydrodynamics, we wouldn't be very far. And the same is true, I think, in the case of the higher questions, like such as what is life. We don't know. We don't know what is. It's a question of principle. It's a basic question. No, but we don't. You don't need the answer to that to do this.
There's no alternative. You start even making such a statement, you're already presupposing something.
But that's
like, the cell, in a sense, is the basic atom of one. The basic, and I don't think you have the concepts to make such a statement yet.
No, but this is where you see biology is historical. You see, that is another of the big difference. As someone once told me. You physicists have a great luck. You are dealing with one universe. Well, maybe not actually, but but in the case of life, we have only one example at hand. You see.
But the point is, the answer, to get back to Lewis's statement, there is only one cell. If I present an alternative cell, another kind of thing. Could have evolved.
I suppose that's possible, but no one.
But even if what would it mean to contradict people?
Aside from finding life on Mars that was totally different. But somebody came up with a model of something that was clearly not a cell.
What would it require for you to say that could be such a framework? Obviously, we're not these spelled out.
The third thing is it doesn't behave according to Darwinian.
That's
the criterion for life.
Criterion for life? Your definition of life is
almost that.
Is that it evolves.
That it evolves. And also there's the energy question, but I didn't care about that again.
No, I mean reproducibility with variation and selection, seems to be.
You set it up in such a way that the only way you can discuss this is by discovering life on other planets. That's one way to go.
It's an experimental question, but then.
I still think there's something still lacking in your conceptual structure so far.
I don't think we care about it. I think what we care about is understanding how cells work. And that's how we know.
Maybe.
You have a very good point, or a good point there. This is one of the major, I think, advantages which came from studying perceptrons or neural networks is actually that now we do understand more or less what learning is, not in the framework of how actually the brain implements it, but to understand the theory of what learning is and how it happens. And now there are alternative algorithms, alternative setups, which actually do particular ways of learning much better than humans do. So this is sort of we understand what connects all that, what is the theory behind what. The port vector machines, for example, do aggregation of postal service database images or zip codes much better than people do at the moment. And for this, basically, in order to do learning, you don't have to study how exactly the brain works. Similarly, I guess the problem which is
exploring here is that in order to study biology, you don't have to actually, maybe you don't have to actually carry out the specific realization of biology which we have at hand, which is our own particular self, how this works. Maybe we should try to abstract from that.
No, what you say basically is that the 747 is not built with flapping wings.
Yes.
You know, and so it's not the only, the birds have not invented all the ways to fly. That is what you are basically saying. But wait.
This something like a neural network may not be dealing with the brain, and it's a sort of a transformation, like all these different equivalent theories we've got, and which look very different. You know, strongly coupled, weakly coupled are equivalent. But also, you can get at something which is sort of equivalent, but nothing like what really happens.
Let's see, I think I'm trying to speak from too low a level here. I just wanted to make the point that if evolution was unique or universal, in physics we believe we know what the universal laws are. And therefore, biology would have to follow uniquely from physics. Now, the equations of
residual interactions.
Heterotic superstring theory are really wonderful. Personally, I think it's extremely unlikely that all of biology follows from these equations. The level of complexity, the equations are simple.
Sure. There's a famous Feynman example of the excited level of the carbon-14 nucleus. If the excited level wasn't there, nucleosynthesis would not have proceeded beyond boron, you know, and we wouldn't be there to talk about it.
Therefore, there must be some role for accident in evolution.
Oh, yes, I mean, I'm quite convinced of that.
Surely
some role.
Accidents must follow physical laws.
Indeed, they do, but the physical laws, by definition, don't determine the accident. That's what we mean by an accident. Every single physical system follows the basic laws of physics.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that the regularities of specific systems, like biological ones, follow uniquely from those laws of physics.
The question is, but that's not the question. If biology proceeded differently, or there's a life form of Sirius, it's reasonable to assume that they won't look human. It's
But in fact, you know, NASA,
however,
when
it's an open question as to whether they would have two eyes or three eyes, you can make a good argument that, you know, it's be crazy for them to have three eyes because two is enough. And it would be a waste. And
there is an actual third eye, you know. There is a third eye.
I think
we can lay down bets on whether the life on Sirius has two or three eyes.
With three eyes, you could see the fifth dimension.
With five eyes, I can find parking on the campus.
Thank you.